Did Mueller's testimony reveal anything new? Are the Democrats any closer to impeachment? Do the voters care anymore?
I'd refer you to the coverage of this in the report.
I yield back on the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Robert Mueller's long-awaited testimony satisfies few, and Republicans call it a waste of time.
There did not seem to me to be a winning hand played on the Republican side unless the contest is to see who gets the most seconds on Fox.
Plus, Democrats feel they've got their best Senate candidate in Kentucky, but Mitch McConnell will be tough to beat.
McGrath. Oh, I think you have to bet on her as the nominee if you're placing bets. But she has to improve her skills at engaging. I think having a primary is a really good test, especially if you're going to go up against Kentucky's political Moby Dick.
And a new book chronicles how Republicans control the entire judicial nominating process, something a future Democratic president may be powerless to stop.
One of the elements of the book that I think is important is how Mitch McConnell's blockade of Obama really contributed to Donald Trump's election. It was a major factor in helping him get elected.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 287 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The rally in North Carolina was a week ago. Shortly before that was a suggestion by President Trump that four congresswomen of color go back to where they came from. In the scheme of the news cycle, it was ages ago. But I still think the moment where President Trump was attacking Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and the crowd in Greenville responded in kind is worth hearing once more.
And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
The message was clear. Dividing the American people by race, by ethnicity, is the path to a second term. The politics of demonization. He may have gotten bad feedback from the rally, and that's what probably led the president to say he was not happy with it, that he disagrees with the North Carolina chant, and that he tried to cut it off by speaking very quickly. That's one reason why we played the tape. What Trump said was patently not true. Besides which, a day after saying he disagreed with the chants, he turned around and called them patriots. Meanwhile, we're just days away from round two of the Democratic presidential debates, this one happening Tuesday and Wednesday in Detroit and airing on CNN. One difference from the Miami debate, Eric Swalwell has withdrawn from the contest, and Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, who didn't make the cut last time, will be on the stage. Like last time, there will be 10 candidates each night. The total number of candidates remains at 24, but far fewer are expected for round three of the debates, which will be held in early September, and where the criteria for making the cut is much tougher. So it's a distinct possibility that many of the candidates we'll see on stage next week could be gone from the race come September. And that brings us to this week's trivia question. Who was the last presidential candidate to drop out of the race before the primaries who later made it onto a presidential ticket? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Once upon a time, Robert Mueller was going to be the vehicle that would end, once and for all, the Trump presidency. That's what many Democrats thought once the former special counsel finished his report outlining Russian efforts to influence the 2016 election and Trump campaign efforts to work with Moscow to make him the 45th president. But with the president declaring that the Mueller report completely exonerated him on things like collusion or obstruction of justice, and with Trump's attorney general and his allies in Congress echoing that assessment, and with Americans' interest in the story waning, Democrats were left with one last resort: have Mueller testify on Capitol Hill. That's what happened on Wednesday. Mueller testified first before the House Judiciary Committee and then the Intelligence Committee. And for the most part, the results were predictable. Democrats praised Mueller for his work and cited parts of his report that put Trump in the harshest light, while Republicans characterized him as either dishonest or an anti-Trump partisan. What satisfied neither party was Mueller often saying that he was not about to or could not comment about specific allegations that weren't already spelled out in his report. And so, when all is said and done, did we advance the ball on any of this? Did we learn anything new? Ron Elving is a senior editor and correspondent for NPR and joins us to talk about Wednesday's hearings. Ron, thanks for this. I know it's been a crazy day.
Good to be with you, though, Ken.
Well, given the fact that Robert Mueller already said that he wouldn't testify to anything other than what was spelled out in the report, and given the fact that the Department of Justice made it clear that there were topics Mueller was not allowed to comment on, was the fact that nothing new seemed to come out of Wednesday's hearings surprising?
No, it wasn't, and expectations were actually quite low on one level. Among people who had looked at the statements that William Barr had made and the statements that Robert Mueller had made, there did not seem to be much of a way to reconcile them, but it was also clear that Mueller was not going to stand up and say, William Barr suppressed my report. He was close to it in some respects in his March 27th letter, which was referred to quite often in the morning hearing in the Judiciary Committee, but he was not willing to get before that committee and say, William Barr ate my homework. He didn't do it. He wouldn't do it. And when they tried to get him to use the word impeachment, which was clearly the portent of some of the statements that were made in the Volume 2 of Mueller's report, when he said there were other constitutional processes to address a sitting president who may have committed a crime, there's really nothing else anyone can imagine that he means other than impeachment. And he did make an oblique reference to it having already been mentioned in the hearing, which of course it had been, but he would not say the word. So his extreme reticence, coupled with the nature of his presentation, which was not at all like the Robert Mueller some of us remember from 10, 20 years ago, all of that together probably meant that despite the was not exonerated headline, which is going to be used, and which of course is accurate, the impact of this particular hearing or set of hearings may still be limited.
What did you make of Mueller's testimony overall? I mean, you mentioned that it wasn't the Mueller of 20 years ago, but I just, the fact that, first of all, he kept referring to the fact that he wasn't at liberty to discuss this, but also he seemed to have trouble hearing. It just seems like he wasn't forceful or on his game the way he could have been.
There are a lot of people who are 74, which Robert Mueller is, who can be a great deal more aggressive in their presentation of a case. I don't think this is simply a matter of age. I think it's probably as much as anything the extreme discomfort with which Robert Mueller was forced to deal with all of this, because he was put in such a straitjacket by William Barr, because he did not feel that he could contradict the statements of the man to whom he made the report, that is William Barr. That was his mission, was to report back to the Attorney General. And because of the extreme unwillingness to make himself the driving force of a major partisan move in Congress, which would be obviously impeachment. He did not want to be the person who gave the push, the shove, that made the Democrats actually impeach President Trump. I think that one other thing is that he really did not want to be featured endlessly in viral videos of himself saying the words in his report. So every time anybody made any reference to a specific part of the report, he would ask the questioner to read it. And then he would say, yes, that's what the report says. So he stayed true to his orders, as it were, from the Attorney General, and he also stayed true to his extreme desire not to be a viral video of himself accusing the president. The basics here are that the president has repeatedly said this report exonerated him completely, not only on collusion, but on obstruction of justice. So Robert Mueller was asked right at the very beginning by Chairman Jerry Nadler of New York, did your report exonerate the president? And Robert Mueller said no.
The president has repeatedly claimed that your report found there was no obstruction and that it completely and totally exonerated him. But that is not what your report said, is it?
Correct. It is not what the report said.
So the report did not conclude that he did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Now, in fact, your report expressly states that it does not exonerate the president.
It does.
So that is really the one takeaway moment, really, for all those who want to set the record straight with respect to the Mueller report, all those who want to go further with the ramifications of what Robert Mueller found. And when you look at the totality of the day, the Intelligence Committee hearing in the afternoon as well, if you link up the seriousness, and Robert Mueller said, of all the threats that I've been involved in, and let's remember he became FBI director right after 9/11, of all the threats that I've been involved to the United States, this is among the most serious, and it deserves the attention of every American. Is it getting that kind of attention? Are people really upset and up in arms about what the Russians did in 2016 and are widely conceded to be planning for 2020? We're not seeing the evidence of that, and that, I think, is also disturbing to Robert Mueller.
There was also something in the Intelligence Committee hearing, the second hearing, when Mueller made comments that were critical of Trump's praise of WikiLeaks.
This just came out, WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks. Donald Trump, October 10th, 2016. This WikiLeaks stuff is unbelievable. It tells you the inner heart. You got to read it. Donald Trump, October 12, 2016. This WikiLeaks is like a treasure trove. Donald Trump, October 31st, 2016. Boy, I love reading those WikiLeaks. Donald Trump, November 4th, 2016. Do any of those quotes disturb you, Mr. Director?
I'm not certain I would say.
How do you react to that?
Well, it's probably problematic is an understatement in terms of what it displays in terms of giving some, I don't know, hope or some boost to what is and should be illegal activity.
Yes, yes. And the question was whether or not it was inappropriate for the president to do that, and Robert Mueller says that's an understatement. He was clearly seeing the encouragement to WikiLeaks as being a borderline situation. Again, as Robert Mueller has said countless times, the word crime is not to be even admitted into the discussion in the case of the president because the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel had decided way back in the 1970s that that was a non-starter, that a sitting president could not be indicted. So from the beginning of Mueller's investigation, he, in a sense, had his head in a bag. He had his hands tied behind him. He could not actually contemplate indicting the president, even if he saw crimes being committed. Now, with respect to criminal conspiracy with the Russians, he says he didn't find such crime. With respect to obstruction of justice, he says he can't say, but that he is not exonerating the president. So that seems to be the bottom line, and it also seems to be the headline on this week's hearings.
And for all the statements that Mueller made saying that he did not and would not and could not charge the president, the Republicans, what I seem to see, is it seemed to make the case that Mueller was this anti-Trump partisan who conducted a very partisan investigation and released a very partisan document.
It's curious to me that the Republicans are not satisfied with simply taking the William Barr version of the report, which is now the official Department of Justice version, and not satisfied with saying, so you didn't find a criminal conspiracy after all that work at it, and so, you know, it's an open question about obstruction of justice. So thank you, Mr. Mueller. Thank you for your work. Why they find it necessary to accuse a lifelong Republican who has given to a number of Republican candidates, who was appointed by three Republican presidents, why they decide to accuse him of being a partisan Democrat, that to me is appealing to something other than the normal court of public opinion. That to me is a contest to be favorably viewed by more of a fringe element of social media and perhaps some of the conservative media.
Well, then we come back to the politics of the whole thing and the winners and losers. I mean, even if the Republicans, and many of the questions I thought were just straying from the facts quite a bit, but they had points to make. Were there any winners?
One winner, I would say, would be Chairman Jerry Nadler, to some degree, with his opening questions to Mueller that elicited the most effective statements of the day. That, it would seem to me, had been a winner. Ted Lieu, a congressman from California, seemed to have gotten Mueller to say that the only reason that he did not indict Donald Trump was because he was the president. That is not quite the way Robert Mueller wanted to have answered that question, and so when he began the second hearing, he began it with a restatement of his answer to Ted Lieu's question. So that pretty much took away that feather in Ted Lieu's cap. There did not seem to me to be a winning hand played on the Republican side, unless the contest is to see who gets the most seconds on Fox.
You know, there was talk, you know, prior to the hearing that the House Democratic leaders were certainly hesitant about impeachment. We know Nancy Pelosi certainly has been hesitant. And basically the argument was that she was decided to wait until Mueller's testimony. Do we think, is there a stronger case for impeachment now than there was before?
The case for impeachment has always been that the president evidently obstructed justice in all of his efforts to undermine Mueller's investigation. And these are laid out in Mueller's report, which he stands by. So if he is not prepared to indict the president for a crime, he has at least laid out the evidence that could be put into articles of impeachment. If you believe that those articles could pass the House, you have to then say what would be their fate in the Senate. And if you're Nancy Pelosi, you have to ask, what do we achieve by impeaching the president in the House? And that's all impeachment is. It's just a vote in the House. It then has to be adjudged by the Senate. That's what we saw with Bill Clinton. It's what we saw with Andrew Johnson. You and I were covering that big story back in the 1860s. And it's what we've seen in the cases of some federal judges and other people who have been impeached other than presidents. It never got to that with Richard Nixon, because when he was told by Barry Goldwater and others that there would be Senate votes to uphold the impeachment from the House to convict him on those charges, he resigned. So we never got quite to that point. But given that the Senate has made it very clear that with everything they know about Donald Trump, with everything that would be in the articles of impeachment, that there would not be Republican votes, or certainly not enough Republican votes for a two-thirds majority, given all of that, what is the sense of the exercise? Is it not a feckless use of time, given that it can't be completed? Is it enough just to impeach him in the House, or would it have to have conviction in the Senate to be meaningful?
Well, Democrats will argue that, first of all, with a Republican Senate with Bill Clinton, they still couldn't get more than 50, 55 votes for conviction. And the Democrats will say, well, look, if the president has committed impeachable acts, our goal is not to worry about what the Senate will do. It's our job as lawmakers, people pledged to the Constitution, to do what's right. I mean, that's what Democrats in the House have been saying.
That's right. And there are 90-some who have said, let's go ahead and initiate the proceedings. Let's keep getting the cameras in here. Let's talk about all the crimes we see the president having committed. And let's use everything that Robert Mueller has given us to portray him in an impeachable light and have the vote, and we'll prevail on our own majority. And then let the Senate cover itself in whatever, cover its head, and simply refuse to look at the facts. Let's put it on them. 90-some are already on board for that. Today, we'll probably expand that number. Certainly isn't going to take away from it. And we'll see if we get up over half of the Democrats being in favor of doing that. I wouldn't predict it, frankly, because I just don't feel as though the dramatics, if you will, the theatrics of this particular hearing were sufficient to move Democrats who think that it's politically a waste of time to the point where they would be willing to make that commitment.
So, and I agree with you on that assessment, which leads to this question. What's next, and is there a next?
What's next is the further pursuit of the subpoenas and the contempt citations.
Which the White House ignores.
Which the White House ignores and will doubtless continue to ignore. They've just adopted a blanket strategy of ignoring all subpoenas and citations of contempt. It creates a terrible atmosphere and a terrible set of precedents, but that is what the White House has chosen to do, and so far successfully, because we don't see anybody going to jail, and we don't see any of this evidence actually being brought forward. And there's been kind of a mixed record so far in the federal courts as to whether they uphold these various efforts to get at information, tax information, other things from the White House. So we've got another 14, 15 months just before the election, a couple months after that, for these probes and investigations to go forward and for hearings to be held in more House committees and for the Senate to stand by drumming its fingers and waiting to see if it's ever going to come to that. It will go forward in some form, in some way, shape, or form. But unless Jerry Nadler just bangs that gavel down in his own mind and says, I'm going to have impeachment hearings. I don't care what Nancy Pelosi says. I'm going to go forward with this, and I'll do it with or without the leadership. Without that, I don't see anything really reaching what we would describe as an impeachment process.
Ron Elving is a senior editor and correspondent for NPR, and he and I have been friends ever since that Andrew Johnson hearing. That was something, wasn't it?
We were just cubs. We were just cubs.
I know, then. I know. Just yeah.
Very
young. And we had our health. And that's what it's all about.
When you got your health, Ken, you can cover the Andrew Johnson impeachment hearings.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Ken. Being with a friend, I said you called back a robber.
If you ask a liberal Democrat which candidate would he or she love to see defeated next year, the first answer would no doubt be President Trump. The second, more likely than not, Mitch McConnell. There's perhaps no person in public office today more responsible for the record of the Trump administration, especially when it comes to filling the judiciary, than McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky, who is seeking his seventh term in 2020. He shepherded Trump's two successful Supreme Court nominees, ensured the confirmation of countless number of judgeships, and has proudly ignored most of the more liberal measures passed by the Democratic House. He was disliked by Democrats even before Trump got to the White House, as he single-handedly blocked President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, of ever getting a vote, let alone a hearing. The most recent Democrat to announce a challenge to McConnell is Amy McGrath, a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel who fought combat missions in Afghanistan and Iraq. She ran a close but ultimately unsuccessful race against Congressman Andy Barr last year. Within 24 hours of her Senate announcement, she raised $2.5 million for her campaign. She used this video to make her case.
Everything that's wrong in Washington had to start someplace. How did it come to this? That even within our own families, we can't talk to each other about the leaders of our country anymore without anger and blame.
And a photo of Mitch McConnell appears on the screen.
Well, it started with this man who was elected a lifetime ago and who has, bit by bit, year by year, turned Washington into something we all despise, where dysfunction and chaos are political weapons, where budgets and healthcare and the Supreme Court are held hostage. A place where ideals go to die.
Yes, McConnell is targeted, but defeating him is another thing altogether. It's a Republican state where President Trump remains very popular. For their part, the McConnell campaign, Team Mitch, distributed a video entitled, "Welcome to the Race, Amy," filled with photos of her along with those of Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others, and clips of her saying things that might not go over well with a majority of voters, starting with, "I'm further left, I'm more progressive than anyone in the state of Kentucky."
"And I think the wall is stupid. I mean, I really do. It's a waste of money.
This is what we need in this country. They're here. They're not going anywhere. Let's bring them in."
"Yes, I would support a move towards universal health care.
If we were to start 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and build a health care system from scratch, I think, my opinion, single payer is the way to go.
I don't think government should be involved making decisions on a woman's body."
"So you think a woman on the way to the hospital to give birth could decide to abort it instead?"
"I don't think that government should be involved in a woman's right to choose."
Al Cross knows Kentucky politics better than anyone. He's the director of the Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues at the University of Kentucky, and before that spent more than 26 years as a reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Al, it's great having you back at the Political Junkie.
Glad to be with you, Ken.
Well, do you agree with my assessment that after President Trump, Democrats want Mitch McConnell defeated more than anyone else?
Probably. He is the most well-known Republican congressional leader, and he has relished in declaring himself the Grim Reaper of the Democratic agenda being put forth by the House.
Well, I think I have two separate questions. How do Kentuckians feel about him? I mean, do they like him? But also, what's the likelihood of that he gets reelected?
Those really are two separate questions, because he is the least popular senator in the United States, in his own state, according to the latest Morning Consult poll. But those polls are essentially surveys in which you're running against yourself. Once Mitch McConnell has to run against somebody else, he's got a pretty good record of beating them. And with Trump on his side in 2020, and the state having trended in a Republican direction, especially the last 10 years, it's almost preposterous to think that he could be defeated. But Donald Trump proved there's nothing impossible in politics anymore, and there are Democrats willing to take on the challenge. In fact, two retired Marine lieutenant colonels.
You know, you talk about unpredictability. I mean, I guess when McConnell was first elected in 1984, he wasn't supposed to beat Walter Huddleston, and he did. So things have gotten, you know, there have been surprises. But as you point out, Kentucky has become more Republican than ever, certainly in the last 10 years. But paring off that question, how strong of a challenge do you think that McGrath could wage?
Well, she looked very strong coming out of the gate. You know, that's a record amount, $2.5 million in one day. But she tried to thread the needle and say that some of the things Trump wanted aren't happening because of McConnell. Basically, that McConnell's keeping Trump from accomplishing what you voted for Trump for. And then she said she probably would have voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh, and then took it back, probably after she got some pushback from contributors and potential contributors. So she had a bad start and is still trying to recover from it. And in the meantime, you have Michael Breuer, another retired Marine lieutenant colonel. This guy was on the ground, not in the air, declaring his candidacy. He was working on a candidacy even before she announced and had the pratfall, but that gave him the opportunity to appeal to people who've been looking for somebody else besides McGrath, because the stuff that the McConnell campaign used against her immediately after she announced was used very skillfully by Republicans in the 6th District congressional race. And in that race, she swore off negative campaigning. She said she wasn't going to attack the incumbent, Andy Barr, because she wanted to set a better example. The race would have been much closer if she had attacked Andy Barr. She probably wouldn't have won. But in this case, she's going right after McConnell because she knows that she has to.
Do we still think, even with these other candidates running, do we still think the nominee will be McGrath, or do we think that her missteps have given the other candidates an opening?
Oh, I think you have to bet on her as the nominee if you're placing bets. But she has to improve her skills at engaging. I think having a primary is a really good test for her or most any other candidate, especially if you're going to go up against Kentucky's political Moby Dick, Mitch McConnell.
You know, I remember, I guess it was 5 years ago when Democrats were all excited about another Kentucky woman, Alison Lundergan Grimes, who I guess was, or maybe she still is, the Secretary of State. But everybody was talking about her as being a real strong challenger to McConnell, and she wound up losing by 15 points.
She proved to be a poor candidate, sort of brittle, parroting memorized lines, and her downfall began when she refused to say whether or not she had voted for Obama in 2012. And McConnell made the race all about Obama. He didn't run against Grimes, ran against Obama. And that's a smart thing to do in this state where Obama was never popular.
You know, the last time, of course, you know this better than anybody, but the last time a Kentucky Republican senator was defeated for reelection was 1974, 45 years ago.
Yes, and Mitch McConnell worked for Marlo Cook, but Marlo Cook went on to be an Obama supporter in his final years.
And if memory serves, I think Marlo Cook endorsed Dee Huddleston against Mitch McConnell, if memory serves. That's kind of interesting. But anyway, it's not going to be easy defeating Mitch McConnell. I think we all agree on that.
No, it's almost prohibitive. But the Democrats probably think, you know, we need to make sure McConnell doesn't have a free ride, because otherwise he can spend these tens of millions of dollars he's going to raise on other people's races.
Al, when's the last time you talked about Marlo Cook in any interview?
When he died a couple of years ago.
Gotcha. You know, there's also a governor's race in Kentucky this year, and you were talking earlier about how unpopular Mitch McConnell is. Well, I read somewhere that Matt Bevin, the Republican governor, is the nation's most unpopular governor. What is it about Kentucky?
He is the most unpopular governor in his home state in the Morning Consult poll, largely because he has a reckless mouth, and he has said some very disparaging and sometimes, frankly, silly things about teachers. He seems to have it in for. He is for charter schools and tuition tax credits and changing teachers' pensions, and the teachers have it in for him and he for them. And when they called a sick out to protest at the Capitol near the end of the legislative session last year, he said, "I'll guarantee you that some child was abused or did drugs for the first time because they had to stay at home because they didn't go to school." And of course, he had no evidence to support that, and no evidence ever came forth to support that.
A few years ago, Bevin challenged McConnell in the Republican primary for McConnell's Senate seat. Have they, the two of them, made up? Obviously, they're both running, in back-to-back years. It's an obvious, I would assume it's in either's interest that they both get reelected, but what's their relationship like today?
Well, it's a business-like relationship. They are cut from very different cloth, but they and their staffs coordinate pretty well together, and it is in McConnell's interest to have Bevin reelected, so he's trying to help that. Bevin is running against Andy Beshear, the son of Steve Beshear, who was the governor for 8 years through 2015 and lost to McConnell in 96 in the Senate race. That was McConnell's second reelection. And those two protagonists, McConnell and Steve Beshear, are really throwbacks to the old days of politics in the state, when there were differences between Republicans and Democrats, but not all that much. And now you have Andy Beshear, who has been attorney general for a term, largely being elected on the strength of his father's name. And he is running kind of a rope-a-dope campaign against a governor who has dug himself a pretty deep hole. At some point, he's going to have to engage him more. The Republicans have already thrown $2 million in attack ads at him. But the Democrats have only spent $500,000. So it looks like Beshear is still ahead. But a lot of the smart money in that race is on Bevin, because Trump will come to town for him. And Trump supporters will say, "Well, I guess Bevin's worth my vote if the president says that he is." the economy in this state is relatively good in most cases, most places. And I think Bashir has yet to prove that he is all that strong a candidate on his own.
Yeah, I remember you wrote back in January, you wrote about Bevin, you said that his chances of winning re-election might be better than you might think. Do you still feel that? Do you still think he...
Well, he went through a primary. He got challenged by a freshman state legislator and only got 52% of the vote in a four-way race. There were two minor candidates, and he didn't look very strong. But I think there was a lot of anti-Bevin vote. A lot of people turned out to just cast a vote against Bevin. And a lot of those people will not go out and cast a vote for a Democrat in the fall. They'll just stay home or skip that race.
Al Cross is the director of the Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues at the University of Kentucky and recently began writing a column for the Northern Kentucky Tribune. Previously, he spent more than 26 years as a reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Al, thanks a lot for being on the show.
You're welcome, Ken.
Rock and roll, Kentucky Fried Flow. What you do that for? Ooh, Domino. Why you won't go? Digital my soul. You can't roll in a Mississippi mo. Rock and roll, Kentucky Fried Flow. What you do that for? Ooh, Domino.
I mentioned earlier that Congressman Eric Swalwell recently became the first member of the crowded Democratic field to drop out of the 2020 race. One reason for Swalwell's departure is that in addition to unimpressive polling and funding, he's facing a potentially serious primary challenger for his California House seat. Whatever the reason, it was good news for John Chaloner of Hayward, California, who won our Guess the First Candidate to Quit the Race contest. Not only does John win a set of Nixon and McGovern buttons from the 1972 presidential campaign, but he's here on the show to share his political acumen. John, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you.
Have you ever been described as somebody with political acumen before?
Only among my family.
Okay, well, actually, I kind of like to think of The Political Junkie as part of your family, if I may be so bold.
I will accept that.
Well, look, you're from Hayward, and so you were probably one of the few out there who even heard of Swalwell before he got in the race.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that he makes extensive appearances on cable news as well, but yes, I've been to a couple of his town hall events, so I like to think I know him quite well.
Well, tell me what you know about him.
I know that he's a former prosecutor, and I know that he sits on several of the most important committees, including the two that were in business today, talking to Robert Mueller.
Why did you think he'd be the first one to drop out?
Well, I really want to give credit to Nathaniel Rakich and Jeffrey Skelly on 538 and Joe Garofoli of the San Francisco Chronicle for giving me all the pieces of information. Basically, what they said is that he was one of the only low-polling Democratic candidates who was facing an upcoming deadline to run for re-election in his current seat. And that he had said that he was only going to stay in the race as long as he could be in the debates, and that his position for the upcoming debate next week was looking pretty tenuous. So, you know, I just put those three things together.
I assume you watched the first debate?
I did, absolutely.
What'd you make of it? I mean, what did you make of Swalwell's performance, and who impressed you the most?
I'll show my home state bias here, and that is the person that impressed me the most was Kamala Harris. But I liked Swalwell's one moment of fame when he took that jab at Biden.
He not only stood up to Biden, I mean, he said basically that, it's time for a new torch, carrying the new torch. But he also stood up to Pete Buttigieg regarding he should have fired the police chief in South Bend. So he was taking on other candidates as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so if Kamala impressed you the most, who impressed you the least?
Well, there's a lot of people on that stage who are not going to be in the race much longer that I didn't pay all that much attention to.
I mean, I want specifics from you because I think there are a lot of people who know of you. You're growing, again, political acumen. People will know who you are. They want to hear from John Chaloner. They want to know what he thinks and how he feels. I just have that feeling, John.
Yeah, okay, all right. So, I mean, of the sort of candidates whose polling is non-trivial, I thought Beto O'Rourke had the weakest performance.
Well, if you had to predict, I mean, we don't have another contest planned anytime soon, but if you had to predict who's the next to drop out?
Oh, so it gets much harder after that, because there's a lot of, so you have Seth Moulton, who still hasn't made a debate stage, but, you know, if he doesn't have any electoral pressure to drop out, I just don't know why he would. But
although I think he has another, he also has a primary challenger in Massachusetts for his House seat. I think he does anyway.
So maybe you could put him down. I mean, I frankly, I think that after this debate, when the DNC majorly ratchets up their eligibility, you're going to see a flock of people leaving all at once.
Yeah, we're talking about the early September debates, where instead of 65,000 individual donors you need now, you'll need 130,000 donors. So that's going to be obviously much larger. By the way, what are you doing, Hayward? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I just finished a PhD in mathematics at UC Davis, and starting in the fall, I will be teaching calculus there.
Oh, wow. Well, it's a pleasure having you on the show. I hope you continue to listen to our program. Is it true that you can't live without the Political Junkie? I'm trying to get some commercial...
Yes, that is true. And in fact, would you like me to say that?
Matter of fact, I think you should say it unprompted. So remember, I didn't tell you to say this. Okay.
You didn't tell me to say that I can't live without the Political Junkie.
Well, thanks, John. Thanks so much for saying that. I really appreciate it. John, congratulations. It's great having you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And speaking of contests, it's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what sitting House member won the most votes in the presidential primaries? The answer, Mo Udall. The liberal congressman from Arizona won more than 1.6 million votes in the 1976 primaries. The nomination went to Jimmy Carter. And the randomly selected winner is Phyllis Stark of Alexandria, Virginia. Phyllis wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And a new Scuttle Button puzzle went up on our site this week. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Momo Mo's always running around.
Momo Mo can never be found.
We don't want to change him, cause he's just Mo the way he is.
For those who weren't convinced, the election of President Trump upended many political norms. But a new book, a new must-read book, shows that decorum and comity were already in short supply by the time of the 2016 election. The book is Confirmation Bias by Carl Hulse, the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. It focuses on the maneuvering between the parties following the 2016 death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, and how Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell denied President Obama a vote on his Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland. But Hulse, to no surprise, spreads the blame around to both parties. He reminds us that Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate leader who was frustrated over GOP stalling over Obama court nominees, worked to end the filibuster regarding judicial nominations, employing what was called the nuclear option, and that McConnell, once the Republicans took over the Senate, took Reid's actions one step further and abolished the filibuster altogether, even in the case of Supreme Court nominations. I have a feeling this is going to be a depressing conversation, but it's an important one. Carl Hulse, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me. And that's sort of the title, Confirmation Bias. You're going to read this book through the lens of your own political positioning. And both parties on Capitol Hill, and also who have occupied the White House, they both think that they were aggrieved by the other side in the nomination process over the last 30 years. And they're still carrying out these grudges to this day. You know, things have a long shelf life in the Senate, and people remember slights from a long time ago, and then they try and get even with each other the first chance they get. And what we've had here is a pretty big breakdown in the nomination and confirmation process that has huge consequences. And one of the elements of the book that I think is important is how Mitch McConnell's blockade of Obama really contributed to Donald Trump's election. It was a major factor in helping him get elected.
Well, one, the fact that you've been covering this stuff for so long and you have that wealth and breadth of knowledge of what's been happening is so invaluable in reading the book. But also one of the biggest lessons I got in reading the book is that, you know, as important as the presidential contest is, control of the Senate is in many ways equally crucial.
Or more important. And it used to be in Washington that on Capitol Hill in both the House and the Senate, but particularly the Senate, they saw themselves as the real stewards of power. Presidents come and go. The Senate is there quite a while, and they would all serve, you know, 30 years, 40 years, some cases. So they had power. But it does drive home the point with Trump getting these two early Supreme Court nominees on. Young guys, comparatively, both in their 50s, they're going to be there a long time after Trump's gone, even if he held to his plan not to leave the White House immediately, which, of course, he won't. But that, you know, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh are going to be on the court for decades, and that will be Trump's legacy there. And on the federal courts, I talk a lot about in the book, it wasn't just the Supreme Court. They set out to remake the federal courts. McConnell, Don McGahn, the White House counsel at the time, Chuck Grassley, they've gotten well over 100 judges on the appeal in district courts, and they do more every day. And McConnell, Senator McConnell, who of course is a leading character in the book, he didn't just change the rules on the Supreme Court. This year they changed the rules to speed up the nomination process so they can move those judges onto the bench even faster. So the consequences of that Garland blockade are going to live for a long, long time. There's just a lot of politics around this. The night that Scalia died, Mitch McConnell was in the Caribbean on a President's Day break. Washington was empty, and he decided right away they were not going to let President Obama fill that seat.
This is not about this particular judge. This is about who should make the appointment. We're in the process of picking a president, and that new president ought to make this appointment, which will affect the Supreme Court maybe for the next quarter of a century.
What's interesting about that, Carl, is that, I mean, to say that, you know, President Obama was not entitled to have his nomination. There were 340 days to go in Obama's term. So it's not that he was leaving office next week.
Yeah, I say in the book at one point, you would think that the moving vans were lined up at the White House driveway, the way the Republicans talk about it. No, and what McConnell's also saying in that little snippet there is important because he didn't want it to become about the nominee because he was worried Merrick Garland, even though some Democrats would have preferred a younger, maybe a minority, more liberal nominee, that Merrick Garland is a qualified person, and he knew if it became about Merrick Garland, it could get very difficult for the Republicans to hold on in this blockade. So he wanted to make it about the position. And of course, you know, there had been Supreme Court justices approved, certainly Anthony Kennedy in a presidential election year. Democrats like to point that out, but Republicans had found examples where Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, Harry Reid had said, well, if there's a opening in a presidential election year, maybe we should hold off. But Joe Biden, who gave maybe the most famous speech about this in 92, a speech he really didn't even remember when it was brought to his attention, that was in June. So we're talking February here. So even if you go by the Biden rule, Mitch McConnell had extended it quite a bit. It was really shocking to most of us in Washington that Mitch McConnell was going to do this, but he managed to pull it off. And Mitch McConnell, in some ways to me, he didn't expect this to work out the way that it did. He was protecting his right flank. He wanted to show conservatives that he was willing to go to the mat to stop Obama from doing this. So he was protecting himself. No one thought Trump was going to win the election, even Trump, obviously.
Here's the thing I never understood, though. Yes, it was a Republican Senate, and maybe they were never going to confirm a lame duck president's nominee, but why not go through the motions, hold hearings, interview him, decide that Garland was too liberal and vote him down? I mean, that's what Democrats did with the Bork nomination. They had hearings and they held a vote. Why put yourself in such a position to just get so criticized?
That was Susan Collins' position to the Republican from Maine, sort of moderate. She had urged them to do that. Here's why, Ken. They worried that if you start a hearing with Merrick Garland, you start going through, people are going to say, listen, there's nothing wrong with this guy. Why would you not confirm him? That he worried that events would take their course and, you know, Chuck Grassley, who's the chairman of that committee, who joined in pretty eagerly in this blockade, would get nervous and say, well, you know, we have to vote on him. We're going to send him to the floor. So that was their reasoning there.
As far as blocking Garland, I mean, the Democrats were no angels either, right? Blocking many of President Bush's judicial nominees.
Yeah, the arc of the story is that one side does say the Republicans are mad about Bork, or they're mad that Harry Reid, let's talk about that, triggers the nuclear option in 2013. So to get on some appeals court judges. So the first chance at Mitch McConnell, who thought that was horrendous and really doing some damage to the Senate, but the first chance he got, he wanted his revenge. So they're going to block Obama's nominee. It's tit for tat in the Senate. And then it always, it always gets a little worse each time. And that's where we're in kind of a dangerous situation, I think, with the nomination process right now, because Democrats routinely now just vote against all Republican nominees. Almost all Democrats vote against Republican nominees, you know, just out of the way the process works. So let's say in 2021, a Democrat gets elected president, but the Republicans hold on to the Senate, which is, you know, a real possibility. And then you go, well, how are Democrats going to get any nominees? How would a Democratic president get any nominees through if the Republicans are just going to say, oh, we don't want anybody? So, and Mitch McConnell has addressed this question already of, well, what would happen if there was a Supreme Court vacancy in 2021 and the Democrats president? How would you handle that? And he said, well, it would be politically unsustainable to block that person for 4 years. So you would probably go through the process, he said, but that's no guarantee that a person could get confirmed. So in some ways, he's saying he would do what you suggest earlier. They would have the hearing and they would have the votes. But if they were still in the majority, that some of those Republicans would have to vote for the Democratic nominee. And, you know, there's now to prove to your base that you're true either party, you have to vote against the nominee. So we're heading a little bit for a train wreck, I think.
Well, I remember, I mean, for all the sainthood that the late John McCain has been elevated to, I remember John McCain saying that he would never vote to confirm any Supreme Court nominee of President Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, there was at the end of this, as the campaign came to a close and it looked like Hillary Clinton was going to win, which everyone expected at that point, McCain and some other Republicans were saying, we're just going to hold this seat open for 4 years. It no longer was about the people. It was about the person. And that person was Hillary Clinton. So there was talk of that. That would be pretty hard to do. But, you know, these things have just gotten so poisonous. The Supreme Court and the lower court judges have become so important because we're having this partisan legislative fights in between Congress, House and Senate, the White House. So what's happening is that the courts in this country are having to decide these disputes over legislation and policy. So they've become more and more important, leading both parties to try and get their own folks on the bench. And it's created this titanic clash that we're dealing with right now. And it potentially, as I say in the book, undermines public faith in the courts if they're just seen to be another extension of our partisan politics, kind of what they're looking like right now.
Did this start with Bork? Did it start with Abe Fortas? I mean, did it start with Andrew Johnson? How far back do we go?
It goes back pretty far, actually. I mean, even when Hamilton, when they started, they were trying to put a lot of judges on and at the last minute. So this has been an ongoing thing, but it's just gotten worse and worse. When I first got to Washington in the 80s, even federal judgeships were a little bit more, it was patronage in some ways. You know, senators handed out judgeships to their rich donor friends who were important lawyers back in their hometowns. The White House would get some. But it's just been ratcheted up. Bork, of course, is important for the Republicans. They think that Bork was treated horribly. Then you get with the Democrats, they think that Obama, that the Republicans were just stonewalling Obama judges. Trump, continuously, when he talks about judges, he has kind of a disingenuous trope that he does where he talks about, oh, when I came into office, I can't believe President Obama left me 100 judge vacancies. Why would he do that? Why weren't they doing the work? Well, of course, the reason those vacancies existed is because Republicans wouldn't let them fill those seats, right? So, you know, everybody's blocking everybody and then hoping to turn the tables when they get in power. Democrats right now and some of the liberal advocacy groups on judicial issues are out there telling older judges on the bench who were appointed by Democrats, don't leave now, wait until 2021, and then you can create some vacancies and let the Democratic president try and restore some more balance on the courts. But of course, that's going to be super difficult if Mitch McConnell is still the majority leader. So you're going to see a lot of emphasis on defeating McConnell, which is going to be very tough. But you're also seeing a lot more discussion by Democratic presidential candidates about what they would do with the Supreme Court if they get in. There's plans to expand the court and put term limits on justices. And they're under a lot of pressure, the Democratic contenders, to say how they would rectify this situation. Much more than Democrats usually talk about the court. Republicans tend to talk more about the court.
I keep reading on social media all these people who are willing to donate body parts to keep Ruth Bader Ginsburg alive, right?
Yeah, another, well, Mitch McConnell, in one of his more artful terms recently when he was talking about if any of the more liberal judges would leave the court, he said it would take a significant life-ending event for one of them to leave. So that was one way to say it. But another Trump appointee to the court, replacing one of the Democratic appointed justices, would really shift that court. Then you would have a decisive conservative majority, and I think it would change the tenor of the court completely.
You know, as you were just talking, I was just thinking, John Paul Stevens, the former Supreme Court justice, one of the court's most liberal members, died last week at the age of 99. Two things struck me. First of all, he was appointed by a Republican president, and that the vote was 98 to nothing. Could you imagine a Republican president nominating a liberal like Stevens and that the Senate would vote unanimously on a nominee?
Yeah, I don't think there's ever going to be another unanimous vote in the Senate on a judge. And I think Justice Scalia was the last one. But that showed you that the times were different then. And when you talk about Justice Stevens, you raise a point. One of the reasons that people didn't think the courts were as partisan as they seem now is because there was always judges appointed by a Republican who would join the liberal side or appointed by a Democrat who would find themselves more conservative. The party label on the president who nominated them wasn't so defining. Now it's pretty defining on the 5-4 court. You know, you can look at most of the decisions. Now they make their deals on some cases, but on the big cases, 5-4 is getting to be pretty routine. And it's 5 Republican nominated justices against 4 Democratic nominated justices.
Carl Hulse is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and the author of the new book, Confirmation Bias. Carl, this is a great book, great reporting, and I really recommend it to anyone who wants to better understand what's going on with the Supreme Court nominations and things like that. Carl, it's great work, and it's a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken. I don't mind talking about my book at all.
Carl, you're the best. Thank you.
Thanks.
The rusted chains of prison are shattered by the sun. I walk the road, horizons change, the tournament's begun. The purple piper plays his tune, the choir softly sing. 3 lullabies in an ancient tongue for the court of the crimson.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and @KenRudinJunkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.